hearty good afternoon to you, everybody. Yes, glad you're with us here, Stan Turner, the eponymous name show here, Stan Turner Show. Thank you for being with us. Well, it seems we can't put two or three beautiful weather days in a row here. We get one step forward and about two back. Get the rain, the chill. We had that this past week. So we'll get grooving and moving and heading in the right direction. Look who's with me this afternoon here. This is the Tom Shoe Guy.
Howdy, sir.
My partner in music Monday through Friday on the All Request and Dedication program. What brings you to the studios this Saturday, my boy?
You know, I just can't get away from you. I'm kind of a groupie for you.
Yeah, I bet you are. Yeah, you run and scream after every Monday through Friday show. No. Nice to have you here. We're giving Kyle, our usual board op and producer, the day of the weekend off, actually, huh?
That's right. He's going for a little bachelor boys weekend. I think he's going to do some paintballing up north.
Paintballing?
Oh, yeah.
Not painting the barn. They're doing paints. Oh, I know what you mean. Okay. We won't go there. Well, you heard the temperature. You know about the weather. We'll give you a look at that a little bit later here, but we want to get moving here with a very important topic, and we can say it in three words. World War One. There may be something of an historical competition over which of America's wars is, quote, our forgotten war. Many people say it's the Korean War, and Korean War vets are rightly upset that so little is mentioned about that war of the early 1950s, a war that killed and wounded so many. You talk about war these days, it seems World War II and Vietnam get a lot of attention, Iraq and Afghanistan too, of course, and rightly so. But what about World War I? Once called the Great War and the War to End All Wars. What about that one? The blood and the carnage from that man-made disaster ran from 1914 to 1918 with casualties in the multiple millions. Surely there are no First World War veterans around now to tell us about it, or to remind us about it, how it was over there. And our boys answered the call back in 1917 when America got into the war. Over there, a popular George M. Cohan anthem, the war during that period. We all need to know more about the war, especially Minnesota's role in it. Some call this war World War I, one of the defining events of the 20th century. And so who better to help us with the chore at hand than Doug Becky? Doug is curator of the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley near Little Falls. Doug is a military historian whose work has taken him to many fields of military endeavor, the latest being World War I and Minnesota's place in it. Doug is a well-respected specialist in military matters, and I'm proud to say a longtime friend of mine. You've been here before. Welcome back, Douglas.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You brought half a museum in here today. You've got some items, some relics, some artifacts from the so-called Great War. That was not great only in terms of numbers and carnage, but it's amazing to look at these things one can actually touch from the American side, from the British side, from the German side, from the French side. Amazing.
Yeah, it's the artifacts are special for me because I'm a museum curator, so that's I work with artifacts all the time. But they're also the physical presence of the past.
Yes.
And through these things, you can touch the past, you can gain an understanding of what it was like to be somewhere in another time, in another place. And, of course, that's what museums do. That's the special thing that museums have to offer, is they present the artifacts, the things from the past.
You have played a leading role in crafting a first-class, a world-class museum up there at Camp Ripley. It is absolutely great. The last major exhibit I saw that you put together was the American Civil War exhibit. Don't know if that's still up there. Mm-hmm. But I imagine eventually we'll see more about World War I as time goes on.
The Civil War exhibit will be up until the end of 2015, and then we're opening up in that same space in 2016 the World War I exhibit, and that'll be tied to the anniversary of the American participation in the Mexican border incident. We just don't have enough space to have opened it up in 2014. I've always been really interested in World War I, so if I had the opportunity, I'd be opening it up right now, but it's just a spatial issue.
What piqued your interest in World War I?
Well, you know, for us now, the World War I veterans are all gone. It's something just grainy black and white photographs and funny-sounding songs.
Yeah, like we
and,
just heard.
Yeah, like you just heard.
Yep, yep.
And it's all very distant and very alien. But for you and I both, when we were growing up, World War I veterans were around everywhere. They were a lot younger than we are now. Mm-hmm. And they were strong influences in my life. And when I listen to these things, when I think about World War One, I see their faces, I hear their voices, I remember the stories they told me. I had several uncles in World War One. My uncle Ray was in the 7th Machine Gun Battalion of the 3rd Division, earned 6 battle stars in 5 months. It was unheard of in World War One for Americans, and saw action in every major American engagement. And my uncle Ray was in the Arnold was in the 6th Division. Didn't see that much action. Got into the Argonne towards the end, and then I had an uncle Bill, Arnold's brother, who was a Marine First Sergeant. And I've got all of his letters home. He wrote a letter home every day. And he was a tough guy. If you look at him, he looks like a bulldog. About 25 years old. And in his letters, he talks about how 1 week he's a boxer. And so they do the boxing at Camp Lejeune. And he's up for corporal. So he must have won the meet, and then he's a corporal. And a week or two later, he writes his mother home, and he says, yeah, I got another match, and if I make this one, I'll be sergeant. And within about a month, he made first sergeant, and which was pretty unheard of in the Marines to get promoted that fast. And he was on the dock ready to go overseas, and they called him back. They wanted him to be a bayonet instructor at camp at Parris Island.
Oh.
And so that's where he stayed throughout the war.
He never went overseas.
He never went overseas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, as you know, I've been in the news reporting business for a long time, and I'm astonished to think, to the best of my recollection, and I know I'd remember, I have never interviewed a World War One veteran. And you have, because there are so many in your family.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think it's one of the great voids in my reporting career, then, and I really feel sad about it.
Yeah.
They're gone now, as you said. We can't retrieve them anymore. We can't talk to them. But fortunately, a lot of authors did and put it down in paper, and even some videotaped them, recorded them, audio tape. So we do have some of those. Are you able to draw on any of those first-person accounts, I hope?
Whenever he can. We talked earlier about some of the books that are out there, especially on the British side.
Right.
Lynn MacDonald's books on the various battles of the First World War, Middlebrook's book, First Day on the Somme,
mm-hmm.
are fabulous books because they're all interviews with the veterans, and so you get the first-person accounts of what happened.
Yeah.
There's another author named Ruben, I forget his first name, he just did a book on the First World War, and he was talking up at St. Cloud a couple weeks ago. And he interviewed some of the last World War One veterans, Americans, and then went back and traced their stories across the battlefields in France into the Argonne and discovered all kinds of interesting things about them. And it was really great. And these men being interviewed as they were right around 100 years old were just completely clear and sharp. And it was just astounding to listen to their stories.
I have saved some news reports in recent years about the passing of some of the last World War One vets. Florence Green, last World War One veteran, dies at the age of 110. One of nation's last World War One veterans dies at 106. Henry Allingham, British veteran of World War One, dies at 113. Well, they're all gone now. I don't think we have anybody left who's just there. Doug, before we plow on here, we need to do a quick overview of World War One. We talk about it in generalities, but it's known as the Great War, or the Brits still call it the 14-18 War, 1914 and 1918. They were in it for a lot longer than we were. But we still shed a lot of blood, the Americans did for sure, and we'll talk about that as we go along. On the one side, the so-called Allied or Entente power side, we have France, the British Empire, Russia. Italy was with us this time around, right?
Italy came in 1915. Originally, right. They were allied with the Germans and the Austrians.
They were. And then the United States, although not fully fledged allies, we were on their side. So we're not officially allies.
Came to be on their side.
Came,
we tried
both,
to stay out of it as long as we could.
Exactly, and we tried. We'll talk more about how we got in. And then, okay, versus the Central Powers, as they were called, the German Empire, okay? Germany was cobbled together in 1871. Okay, Germany, Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire, based in Turkey, and Bulgaria. Those were the main belligerents on the other side.
Right.
So there we have it. And you can talk about the growing menace of imperialism back then, and it certainly was a very big deal. But the trigger, as a lot of us will recall from our school days, happened in June 1914, the latter days of June. as we said, a resurgence of imperialism. There are a lot of monarchies around in Europe in the time. That's one underlying cause, a lot of those monarchies reaching out for more land, more power. The immediate trigger for World War One, though, was the 28th of June, 1914 assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria. He was heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. This done by a Yugoslav nationalist,
pre-Yugoslavia.
Yeah, pre-Yugoslavia, Gavrilo Princip, the man's name. Still a name in history that we learn about. Anyway, that was the flashpoint. And all of these interlocking alliances threw everybody into the conflict. Interesting, on the day after the assassination of the Archduke, people were sitting around in Vienna, Austria, drinking wine and listening to music. There was no panic. There was no outward concern. Mm-hmm. Strange how this thing unfolded. Mm-hmm. Before long, the blood was flowing.
The Tsar ordered the mobilization of the Russian armies and then went for a long walk and went swimming, said he had a great day. And,
amazing.
It was a strange war. It never should have happened. It was a strange mix of alliances that came together, in some cases, almost at the last minute. Mm-hmm. And it could have been called off at any time, right up till the start of hostilities.
You mentioned the author Martin Middlebrook, who's become a friend of mine. He's a Brit who has written mostly about the air war in World War II, but he got started writing about the Somme, and you've visited that battlefield, the awful, awful slaughter at the Somme. In Europe in World War One, he writes, Britain's stated war aim was to secure the neutrality of Belgium. That was the stated aim. But in reality, Britain wished to curb the power of Germany, whom she regarded as a growing rival to Britain's trade, maritime, and imperial interests. It was for Britain a very popular declaration of war. The entire country and beyond it, the empire, the British Empire, entered wholeheartedly into the conflict. For most of the men who wished to fight, there was only one anxiety, that the war would end before they could get into action. The popular forecast was all over by Christmas 1914. They couldn't know, could they, Doug, what this slaughter would be?
No, went on for a long time.
It did.
But they kept enlisting right till the end.
How many men did Britain alone lose? Do we know? Will we ever know?
Oh, I don't have that figure here, but it was under a million, which is, you know, a lot of them lost well over a million.
Yeah. I have kept one piece from the London Observer newspaper. It just resonates, and I can't get it out of my mind. I'll just read a piece of it here. When General Sir John Cowley was a small boy, his Uncle Charlie came down to his prep school and took him out to tea in Weymouth. It was the summer term of 1916. Uncle Charlie was in command of a brigade on the Western Front, one of the many slaughterhouses there. A woman in the tea shop saw Uncle Charlie's uniform and asked him, "How do you like it in France?" He thought for a moment and said, "I simply love it, every single moment of it." And when she had left the room, he turned to me and said, "To think that there are people in England who can ask a question like that." 2 weeks later, the Battle of the Somme began. The British lost 60,000 dead and wounded on the first day, with Cowley's Uncle Charlie among the dead. Amazing. Even then, 2 years into the war, some people in Britain, civilians, didn't get it, did they?
Well, and the majority of the men on the British Army who fought on the Somme were of Kitchener's Army. They were the volunteers that that came in after the war started. And they enlisted by locality, they enlisted by a job place. If any of you were watching Selfridges, they all enlisted from that company and went overseas together. And of course, they went into the Somme with great enthusiasm, thinking they're just going to sweep the Germans aside, and they took casualties, and it was devastating to a lot of small communities. So you'd get the Liverpool Pals or an organization like that, they'd be wiped out. And so these communities just lost all the young men together. And right after the Somme, then they started breaking these units up and integrating, spreading the men out throughout various units,
right. So
that if one unit was devastated, it wouldn't all come from one region.
World War II, the Bedford Boys, though.
Same kind of a situation.
Same kind of a deal there. So, folks, it's as if, say, regiments were drawn from boys in Hopkins and were sent in, and God forbid, you know, them became casualties. A huge hole suddenly in Hopkins, the young men, you know. gone.
That's
just
right.
Like that. So, amazing. We want to talk about Minnesota's role, both on the home front and overseas in World War I. We're talking with Doug Becky, who is curator of the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley up near Little Falls, Minnesota. Doug is a military scholar, a man who is putting together an exhibit, which will eventually be on display on show at the Military Museum. And we're also going to talk about some plans that are afoot for an exhibit, a traveling exhibit that'll start at the Minnesota History Center in St. Paul in a year or so. So we'll talk about that. But first and foremost, we want to focus on our own home state of Minnesota, maybe Wisconsin too. We're going to take a break. Back with Doug Becky right after this.
At Hymie's Haberdashery, men never sacrifice fashion for weather. So no matter how cold it gets, you can still spot a Hymie's man by his impeccable taste and the confidence that only comes from a hot lather shave. Hymie's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Create a look that's uniquely yours with tailored suits, overcoats, hats, and accessories that make winter blush and at prices that won't melt your wallet. Hymie's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Hymie's.com.
The Valley Bookseller has one of its most popular events coming up this weekend. From Friday to Monday, it's the Customer Appreciation Sale. That includes 10% off practically everything in the store. But if you are a frequent Buyers Club member, you get 20% off. Not a frequent Buyers Club member yet? Ask any of the staff about all the benefits and then join up. This is a great time to join, and then you save every time you shop all year long. Valley Bookseller, located at 217 Main Street North in Stillwater. More events can be seen on their website, valleybookseller.com. Great books, great people.
An historic fine dining restaurant experience awaits you at the Orchard of Baldwin, just east of the Twin Cities in Baldwin, Wisconsin. Not only do they have nightly dinner specials and an amazing Sunday brunch, but did you know it is also one of the area's largest and busiest wedding facilities? They have enough staff and banquet areas to hold two weddings at once. At the Orchard Restaurant, they can do private parties, large or small. They also do reunions and corporate meetings better than anyone. Check them out online or call 715-688-6666. That's 715-688-6666.
Hello, Kilfa the Viking here for Viking Meadows Golf Club. Half mile off of Highway 65 in East Bethel, Viking Meadows is a beautiful USGA course. And as a Viking, you know I appreciate beauty. But there's something else, something special about this course. When I get out there, my drives are longer, my shots are straighter. Maybe it's me. Maybe it's the name. Maybe it's the course. Viking Meadows in East Bethel. Book a tee time at vikingmeadows.com.
Up to mighty London came an Irishman one day. As the streets are paved with gold, for everyone was gay. Singing songs of Piccadilly, Strand and Leicester Square. Till Paddy got excited, then he shouted to them there. It's a long way to Tipperary.
There's a popular, well-known song from World War I, the superb tenor voice, Irish tenor voice of John McCormick there. That song, of course, a reference to the town of Tipperary, Ireland. You've come a long, long way. Yes, during the First World War, a Daily Mail correspondent, George Curnock, saw the Irish regiment, the Connaught Rangers, singing that song as they marched through Boulogne on 13 August 1914 and reported it. The song was quickly picked up by other units of the British Army and was recorded by John McCormick, whom we just heard, and it's become one of the most popular songs to grow out of the First World War. We're talking about that terrible conflict, that huge slaughterhouse in Europe. 100 years ago, that war started. We're talking with Doug Becky, a military historian, curator of the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley. Doug, glad to have you here. Looking around, we see memorials, we see statuary depicting some people from World War II, Korea. You go down to the front lawn of the State Capitol building in St. Paul, you'll see some of those things. What about World War I monuments around us? Many?
Well, there's a huge monument in North Minneapolis that people aren't aware of, Victory Memorial Drive. Every tree on Victory Memorial Drive is dedicated to a citizen of Minneapolis who fell in the First War. And on the north end of the drive is a large monument with a large flagpole and bronze plaques listing all their names. On the river bluff at the west end of Summit Avenue is a large monument to World War One, and a curiosity on the shore of, on the drive around Lake of the Isles, mm-hmm. is PV Fountain. And PV Fountain is dedicated to the horses of the 151st Field Artillery in the First World War.
Really?
The 151st Field Artillery was Minnesota's premier unit, and the unit from Minnesota, the Minnesota National Guard, that saw the most combat.
Wow. You have just educated me and many others. I didn't know these things, and I should have, and shame on me. What about the Capitol Approach area, Minnesota State Capitol? Any World War One? I can't recall of any. I don't think there's anything.
Can't think of anything over there, but I haven't looked into it. Now I will.
I think I can preempt you by saying there's nothing there that pertains to World War One that I know of. Before Twin Cities International Airport was built, it was called Wold Chamberlain Field, and that has a World War One connection, a big one, doesn't it?
Well, a post-World War One connection, really, when...
It's named after two World War One flyers who were killed in the war.
That's right.
It has a very big World War One connection. Mm-hmm. So Wold Chamberlain, that used to be the name of the place.
Yeah. And you talk about monuments, you know, our participation in the war started in April of 1917. Right. The first two Americans were killed in September of 1917. They were part of the 11th Engineers, and they were in the Somme area up with the British, and they were killed in an artillery barrage. But the Americans really didn't start getting involved until April or March of 1918, with the 1st Division and the 2nd Division and the 26th Division working up with the British. But the real heavy fighting didn't start until around the 1st of June of 1918. And then, of course, it was all over on the 11th of November of 1918. So the Europeans have been slaughtering each other for 3 years by the time we got heavily involved, 4 years. And but when you go to France, it's interesting because a lot of the largest monuments, and they're all over France, are American monuments.
Really?
Yeah, either national monuments maintained by the Battlefield Monuments Commission or a lot of state monuments. There's some unit monuments. Mm-hmm. But the cemeteries over there are just absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. There's not a blade of grass out of place anywhere. They're just absolutely perfect.
Mm-hmm. You've walked them all. You've walked the battlefields, too, of World War One. And we'll have you take us on a virtual tour of those in just a minute. But I want to ask you, why, to those of the folks listening, why did it take America so long to get in the war? The war broke out in August of 1914, and we didn't get in until April of 1917. And really, the troops didn't get overseas, as you said, till the spring the following year. The war ended November 11th, 1918, so we weren't there that long. What took us so long?
Well, we just didn't want to get involved in Europeans' mess, and we saw it as their trouble, and we should stay out of it, and we needed to deal with our own Western Hemisphere issues, and didn't want to be involved with the old world issues. We weren't so hesitant to supply them with munitions and armaments that were produced by American factories. But, you know, there was a lot of conflict initially in the war, too. About 30% of the American population at the time was either foreign-born or first-generation Americans. And so people still had some degree of loyalties to the home country.
You can talk about Minnesota in that context very much so, because a lot of people of German ancestry, as you say, immigrants or first generation, second generation.
That's right. All over the Midwest, a lot in the Dakotas, too, and Wisconsin, of course.
Wisconsin, right here.
And there were some fears unfounded that Milwaukee and Cincinnati, large German cities, would revolt, and a lot of this sort of thing. But, you know, there was, we look at immigration issues now, and you hear some of the same arguments now or discussions that were taking place then. In those days, it was the Germans. Oh, they have their own language, and they don't want to assimilate, and they go to church, and they listen to German sermons and their newspapers, and they have their own schools, and it's all in German, and they'll never assimilate. Mm-hmm. And so the fear was the Germans in those days.
Right. Well, there's some very real fears on part of people here in Minnesota and Wisconsin of German ancestry that they might wind up fighting their cousins over there. That was a very real, well-founded fear. I'm sure it happened in some cases.
It happened in a lot of cases, and they went. There weren't any significant issues. There's always a certain degree of dissent and that, but by and large, they went, and they served with honor.
There was a fair amount of anti-German hysteria in Minnesota, for sure, during that time. If you go to the State Capitol building in St. Paul, go down to the basement on the north end, and you'll see what is now a cafeteria. It was done up after the Capitol opened in the early part of the 20th century as kind of a German beer hall.
The Rotzkeller.
The Rotzkeller, and you can see all this elaborate German-style printing and the scenes of old Germany and all the rest. That was quickly painted over with the outbreak of World War One, Doug, and it wasn't until recent years that they finally brought it back and restored it.
Mm-hmm. Because of the blockade of Europe by the British, we were really cut off from the Germans and German propaganda efforts. And the German propaganda efforts were also fairly clumsy and less effective. The British were extremely effective in their propaganda efforts, to the point that if you look at a map of the Balkans prior to 1914, the country of Serbia is listed as Servia.
Oh.
And the British felt that that connotated servitude, and they actually changed the name of the country to Serbia.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, have you heard of a German shepherd being referred to as an Alsatian? Yeah. There's all kinds of things. It
right.
was incredible. The British propaganda was extremely effective.
But the state of Minnesota set up what turned out to be a patently unconstitutional and undemocratic commission called the Commission of Public Safety. And it was set up to blunt any sort of effort, real or imagined, and most of it was imagined, of disloyalty among Minnesota citizens. And the people were frowned upon for uttering anything in the German language, although it wasn't fully illegal to say it. You were suddenly under suspicion. The state actually had spies. The Pinkerton Agency were out there eavesdropping on people, and people were brought in and arrested. This was amazing. This could happen, but Douglas, it did.
It was wartime, and it happens in many wars. And, you know, get on board with the war effort.
Yeah, but this is a particularly egregious effort, undemocratic.
It happened in the Civil War. Yeah. Look at the internment of the Japanese in World War II.
Yep, that's true.
So
that's all very true. So, by the way, this commission was undone by about 1920. They got rid of it. And but it was just another example of the war hysteria here. As you say, it happens in times of war. It does indeed. All right, let's talk about Minnesota. And, by the way, we're going to want to talk about all these artifacts that you brought in here in just a minute. But first, Minnesotans in World War I. Can you give us some numbers? We don't want to, folks, we don't want to drown you in statistics, but it is helpful to understand the extent to which Minnesota participated, contributed to the war, both on the fighting fronts and back here. Doug?
Sure. Well, the draft was reinstituted on the 18th of May in 1917, and 542,000 Minnesotans were registered, of which 146,000 were classified as first class, that eligible for the draft. 253,900 were deferred.
Really?
Yeah, they were deferred. Now, 39...
Do you know why? What were the common causes they were deferred?
I suppose okay. Physical health, inability, yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
39,000 served in the National Guard or enlisted, so they counted as all enlistees. 79,000 were drafted. And so we had 118,497 Minnesotans who served altogether. And let's see.
Does that mean overseas or just in uniform?
That served in uniform.
Okay.
Served in uniform.
In uniform. Okay.
Now, the Minnesota National Guard people went into the 34th Division. And prior to World War I, there was congressional legislation that established how the Army would be reformulated in time of a major war. So prior to World War I, prior to our entry, the units were the 1st Minnesota, 2nd Minnesota, 3rd Minnesota, whatever, 1st okay. Minnesota Artillery, and you get the same thing in Wisconsin and the same thing in Iowa. Mm-hmm. So they needed a national framework to set this up. So when the war started, the National Guard divisions came from a pool of divisions, and then the higher number divisions were the draftee divisions. And so the Minnesota National Guard formed the nucleus of the 34th Division, and they were sent down to camp...
Was this the Red Bull Division?
The Red Bull Division,
yeah.
Yeah, but
right.
It wasn't the Red Bull Division then. It was the Sandstorm Division.
Oh.
They were formed in Deming, New Mexico, at Camp Cody in the desert. And so the design came from the steer skull laying in the desert. And the basic outline is a Mexican water jug.
Ah.
And so they took the name the Sandstorm Division, and that stayed with them until World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't go overseas until the very end of the war. They didn't see much combat. They were used as a replacement division for supplying trained soldiers to other units. And the one exception would be the 151st Field Artillery that became part of the Rainbow Division and served in France with great distinction. Its commander was George Leach. Leach came home to become, I think, the five-term mayor of Minneapolis, later went on to become the head of the National Guard Bureau and a very distinguished Minnesota citizen. And then the 151st went back to the 34th, served with them through World War II, and still exists. They've been to Iraq and served all over.
Doug, what are some of the campaigns over in Europe in which Minnesotans fought, some of the major battles?
Well, as individuals, they served in all the major campaigns. So you'd find them in the early campaigns, Cantigny with the British in the 1st Division in the spring of 1918. And then, as I mentioned, my uncle sitting behind his French Hotchkiss machine gun on the Marne River at Chateau Thierry, and then to Belleau Wood supporting the Marines. And St. Mihiel, north from the Marne up to Soissons, and then over to St. Mihiel. And then, of course, the major offensive was the Argonne. But by the end of the war, Americans still were building. American artillery, American airplanes were still only playing a very, very minor part in the war. We were using French and British equipment primarily. The thought was that the Germans were going to hold out, and the major offensive to push into Germany was going to take place in 1919.
Wow.
And if that had happened, then the Americans would have played a very major role.
What about Minnesota casualties over there, World War I overseas?
Yeah, there were, like I said, 118,000 Minnesotans who served. 104,000 were in the Army, and there were 1,319 Army casualties. There were 11,000 sailors from Minnesota. There was only 8 casualties there. The Marines had 2,800, and they had 105 casualties.
Mm-hmm. When we say casualties in military parlance, that means a combination of dead, wounded, missing, prisoners of war, that sort of thing.
No, I'm sorry, I misspoke. Okay. That's killed.
Killed. Oh, the numbers you gave us.
Those are combat killed, or killed in action or died of wounds.
Okay. Those are tricky terms because casualties is more of an umbrella
term, isn't
it?
That's right. Okay. That's right. Yeah, okay. And I don't have the figures for the number of wounded.
We should tell you, and if you need to be reminded, that the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century put into the hands of military people some killing machines, the likes of which the world had never seen before. Tanks, machine guns, even airplanes, and so it was death dug on the wholesale level, wasn't it, World
War
One?
That's right.
Absolute
and
slaughter.
Gas, of course, was a major contributor.
Yes. Yeah, both sides. We used it too.
Yeah, massed artillery,
right? Massed artillery. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, it was killing on a huge scale. No question about it. So, we're going to take a quick break here. Let's do this. We'll come back and talk about some of the World War One relics that you brought in here, and some other aspects of our participation in the war here. What it's all about. What the aftermath brought us, and some other things that Doug is involved in too. Doug Becky with us here, military historian. We'll be right back after this.
At Hymie's Haberdashery, men never sacrifice fashion for weather. So no matter how cold it gets, you can still spot a Hymie's man by his impeccable taste and the confidence that only comes from a hot lather shave. Hymie's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Create a look that's uniquely yours with tailored suits, overcoats, hats, and accessories that make winter blush and at prices that won't melt your wallet. Hymie's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Hymie's.com.
The Valley Bookseller has one of its most popular events coming up this weekend. From Friday to Monday, it's the Customer Appreciation Sale. That includes 10% off practically everything in the store. But if you are a frequent Buyers Club member, you get 20% off. Not a frequent Buyers Club member yet? Ask any of the staff about all the benefits and then join up. This is a great time to join, and then you save every time you shop all year long. Valley Bookseller, located at 217 Main Street North in Stillwater. More events can be seen on their website, valleybookseller.com. Great books, great people.
We've been family-owned since 1922, and we still believe that it all starts with you.
Happy Father's Day. This is DJ Redund's third-generation owner of Stillwater Motors and family-owned and operated since 1922. This Father's Day, I'd like to help you give Dad the very best seat in the house. Visit Stillwater Motors anytime before Father's Day and we'll give you a free Best Chairs recliner, the only chair that sits like a glove with the purchase of any new Chevrolet Silverado now through June 16th. Stop by today and choose from our huge selection of Chevrolet Silverados, the North American Auto Show Truck of the Year, and you get a comfortable recliner for Dad or someone special in your life. Visit Stillwater Motors at the corners of Highway 36 and 5 in the birthplace of Minnesota and online at stillwatermotors.com. Say Happy Father's Day this year with the best seat in the house from Stillwater Motors.
Stillwater Motors, good people to know.
He'll kiss his cheek and holler, ooh la la, how you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry?
Yes, indeedy. Nora Bays asking the musical question, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Gay Perry? Yes, the Doughboys, as they were called, went overseas, some of them right off the farm, and once they saw the big cities and all the rest, folks, when they came back, if they did come back, they were changed. They were changed. And the song, popular in 1918, talks about that indeed. Doug Beckey is our guest today, military historian, curator at the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley near Little Falls, talking about World War I. He's working on some projects involved there. To the extent, Doug, that you are walking the battlefields of World War I in Europe, you've been to all the major ones, and what's that like? Did World War II churn up a lot of the trench lines and all the rest from World War I, or pretty much intact still?
For the most part, World War II's battlefields were in different places from the World War I battlefields. And so the World War I battlefields are largely intact. And as you drive through the countryside in France, it's just gorgeous. France is just a beautiful country. And I've always, all my trips, I've always found the French to be extremely friendly, very, very nice, very welcoming. And as you drive along, it's just beautiful farm country and quaint little villages. And then you look and you'll see a cemetery here and there. And in the British battlefield areas, there's lots of cemeteries because they didn't consolidate their cemeteries the way we did and the way the Germans and the way the French did. So there's little cemetery plots all over the British battlefields. And then you'll notice monuments every now and then along the road, sometimes to an individual soldier, sometimes to a regiment. And that's about the only sign of it until you get out of the car and start actually walking the battlefields. And the battlefield area was contained to a fairly narrow stretch of land that went through Belgium from the North Sea coast, mm-hmm. and swept through France and then down to the Swiss border. And the front didn't change that much, maybe 20, 25 miles in some of the widest areas. And so it's all very contained, and the battlefields were fought over again. And so the rubble, the debris of the war is concentrated there. So after the end of the war, the French wanted to restore this land. And because they wanted, the farmers wanted to use it, they wanted their villages back. And so there was a major effort to restore the land. And what had been forest was returned to forest. What had been farmland was returned to farmland. What had been a village was returned to a village. And what had been pasture went back to pasture. And so the farmland looks just like beautiful farmland. When you go into the forests, it's all shell holes and craters and trenches, and you can find all this stuff. And if you get out, and if the farmers agree, you have to be respectful of the French. It's their land. And if you walk through the plowed fields, especially in the fall, all kinds of stuff is churned up. An English friend of mine told me that on the Somme, they're expecting to be plowing up artillery shells for the next 200 years.
Some of them are still live.
Lots of them are still live, yeah. Yes, and the French and the Belgians maintain explosive ordnance demolition teams all the time, and it's their job to go pick these things up. We were walking some of the trench lines in the Somme area 2 years ago and looked in the middle of the field, and there was a huge artillery shell that the farmer had just plowed up. And so we went over, and he was on his tractor, and we went over and asked him. He said, you know, can we go out and look at this in the field? And he says, yeah, you should take it with you, you know, to get rid of it. Because they plow them up all the time, and occasionally French farmers die from these things.
No, it's not far off.
But if you look in the furrows, you find all the debris of war.
You brought some along today.
I brought some of these things along. These are all from the Somme, part of a rum jug. The British got a rum ration. Mm-hmm. And stiffen their backs a little bit, supposedly.
Yep, yep.
And the rum jug fragments are everywhere. They're all over the place. This is a fuse from a German artillery shell, part of a Mills bomb, the British hand grenade found in the Somme. The driving band, the brass driving band from an artillery shell. And these are pieces of shrapnel from the shrapnel rounds. And you look at like little BBs or little...
pellets.
Marbles.
Marbles.
And you walk along and they're just laying there. They're all over the place. And occasionally you find human bones plowed up.
I know one farmer plowed up a pen, a Parker pen, that still had ink in it. It was from the body of a World War I casualty.
Yeah.
I mean, the bones were left, fragments of uniform, but the pen still wrote, still was...
In many of the battlefield areas, there are very active in archaeological efforts to dig up the trenches and to find the lost graves.
Right.
And in some cases, they can identify the soldiers. The first time I went to the San Miguel Cemetery, the American cemetery, I was talking to the director there, and the directors are usually Americans, and he was telling me that the cemetery was laid out perfectly after the war. And there's one grave that's out of sequence, and that was an American who was found in the late 60s, and he was an American Marine. And they were able to find him because the Americans had aluminum, they were able to identify him because the Americans had aluminum dog tags, and the dog tag was with the body, and they contacted the family and said, do you want us to bring him home? And they said, no, you know, leave him there and that, bury him with his comrades. So he's in the San Miguel Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
The British had a dog tag made out of a composition material.
They did it in World War II.
They did it in World War II, too, and it disintegrates.
It does.
And
it
so
does.
Usually when they find the bodies, unless they have a civilian acquired metal dog tag, identification tag, they can't identify them.
Amazing.
Yeah. The Germans had a metal tag, too, so sometimes they can be identified.
Right. We're talking about war by stalemate. Trench warfare was just awful. It wasn't just one line of trenches. There were many lines of trenches, weren't there? Supply trenches, all the rest. But they could fight for 3 months and maybe gain, 500 yards of mud and gore and blood. It was god-awful, Doug.
Well, it's defense in depth.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the areas in France are a chalky soil, and so you could build your bunkers deep.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Germans were fighting on two fronts, and so in 1915 they made the decision to go on the offensive in the east and hold the west in a defensive posture. So it was usually the Allies, the Western powers, that were advancing and attacking against very well-entrenched Germans in very good fortified positions.
You have brought along today, Doug Becky, some amazing relics of World War I, many of them uniform pieces and at least one bayonet here. Tell us a little bit about what you've got here, including what the Germans or what the Allies used to call in both World War I and II, potato mashers. These were the stick-handled grenades that the Germans used in both wars. You've got one right here from World War
I.
I don't think it's going to go off, is it?
No, you know? It's just an empty tin can with a wooden stick on it now. But it's a concussion grenade, and when I was at Verdun in the 70s, you could find areas in the battlefield where you could go in. And Verdun was so devastated that at the end of the war, they decided to turn the whole area into a huge national forest. And if you'd go in a little ways into the trees, into the tree line, you'd find all the trenches intact, all the shell holes were still there. And still in 1975, on the edge of the shell holes, you'd still find a pile of grenades ready to be thrown. It was unbelievable, both German grenades and French grenades. And behind the trench line, you'd find piles of rations. Every kind of equipment was laying around. Well, in the 80s, a lot of diggers went in and really started looting the battlefields, and the French clamped down very tightly. And it's extremely, it's very... very forbidden to go into these areas now, and the fines are crippling, and the punishments are crippling. So you don't want to do it. Yeah,
bayonet here, or bayonet British.
Yeah, this is an early war bayonet, and you know, in many ways, World War I marked the end of the 19th century.
Yeah.
And so you look at things from the first year or two of the war, especially the first year of the war, and they're very much things from the 19th century. I've got a French hat here that is the brick red, and they had brick red pants and long overcoats. And if you look at the weight of the wool, and you think about them wearing this in August, and it was really hot. And the French wore their overcoats 12 months of the year. That was their regulation.
And they were bright blue with red hats. Huh?
Well, dark blue. It was a navy blue coat. Their chaussures, some of the people had lighter blue. In 1915, they switched their uniform to a horizon blue, a light blue, which turned to a gray and brown in the mud. It didn't take too long. And the Germans had their famous pickle helm, the spike helmet.
Yep. Oh, you've got a beautiful example
here. Yeah.
Put a cloth cover on it.
For a little bit of camouflage effect, but it's very much a helmet of the 19th century. It offered no real protection at all, and it was just decorative. And an interesting note that the Germans had developed this in the 1860s, and after they won the Franco-Prussian War, the Americans stopped copying the French military uniforms and traditions and started adopting Prussian symbols and uniforms. And we wore a spike helmet almost until after the Spanish-American War.
Amazing.
Yeah. I have to ask, what's the purpose for the spike?
Strictly decorative.
The spike represents a spear. The artillery units had a ball on the top representing a cannonball.
Okay.
And this pickle helmet is named the man who wore it, probably.
Yeah, and a machine gun unit. The 48th cover is marked, what is it here?
The man's name is Altman.
Yeah, Musketeer Altman.
Yeah, yeah.
Machine and Gevier Company of Jaeger Regiments.
That's amazing.
48. Yeah.
Touching history right here 100 years ago. Yeah. Also, you've got the more traditional German helmet, the one that we're familiar with from World War II. In fact, Americans have adopted a similar shape now, or did some years ago. But here's the real thing. This is another on loan again from museums here. Yeah. This is an amazing and well-preserved relic of the traditional German World War I and World War II helmet.
The 1917 helmet, and it's interesting because all three of the major belligerent nations, the British, the French, and the Germans, went back to old medieval styles for their helmets. Mm. And this is somewhat reminiscent of a medieval German helmet in its design. The French went to one that was reminiscent of a classic French design.
Right.
And the British helmet... the British adopted a helmet that referenced back to the old medieval archer's helmet. The design was didn't cover the top of the depth of the head the way the Germans did, but it was meant to deflect air bursts and stuff falling out of the sky onto your head. And this one's kind of interesting because yes. This is camouflage. It's a British helmet, but it must have been issued to an American because it has camouflage on it. The British, for the most part, didn't camouflage their helmets. And Americans got a lot of British helmets. And our own helmet was virtually identical to the British helmet. But in the camouflage design is painted a woman's leg with her silk stocking and her high heel. And, we forget that these were young men.
Yes.
And they had a lot of the same interests that young men have today.
I would think so. Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's one of these little humanizing things that we don't think about.
Yeah. Hey, you have a British officer's peaked cap or visor cap.
Yeah, this is actually an enlisted man's hat.
Enlisted man, okay.
And this is the hat that they went to war with. It was stiff. And as the war progressed, they took the stiffeners out and they wore them. And think about the 50 Mission Crush hats.
Right, World War II.
From World War II, and they were very similar to that.
Amazing.
But again, it's very much a piece of the 19th century. It offered no protection whatsoever. And it wasn't until 1916 that they came in with the steel helmets.
Wow. The songs we've been playing from World War I. How about My Buddy, Doug? That was a popular one, especially after the war. I think the veterans were thinking back about all the friends they lost.
Yeah, yeah.
This, I think we can give you a little sample of My Buddy right here. That's a serenade to camaraderie there. Henry Burr is the vocal artist there from a long, long time ago. My Buddy, Bing Crosby, had a big hit with that later years. Well, Doug, the war, World War I, finally ground to an end on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 1918, and four monarchies, four empires were in dust at the end of the war. In Europe, the Allied forces emerged victorious. And then the Versailles peace treaties and all the rest, and a lot of scholars think that they were so punitive toward the Germans that it handed Hitler and other crazy fanatics, a cause they could carry and start another war and exact their revenge. What do you think about that?
Well, the World War I shaped the 20th century and still even into the 21st century.
That's a key phrase, isn't it? World War I shaped
the
century.
Yeah, the Russian Revolution in 1917. Led to huge slaughters, both in Russia and in China. You could say the Cold War came out of it. The World War I generation doesn't get a lot of the credit it needs. We've been spending the last 20 years talking about the greatest generation, but who were their parents? Who gave birth to them? Who raised them? Who were their teachers? Think about all the generals in World War II were World War I veterans, mm-hmm. the captains of industry for
Patton,
World War II.
Right?
Yeah,
right.
They were all World War I people.
Yeah, they were indeed. What about the punitive nature of the peace treaty? What do you think? I know you're a military historian, not a political historian, but...
Well, one of the goals of the Versailles Treaty was to reestablish, was to redraw the borders of the world, supposedly to meet the ethnic needs of the various populations, but they left out the Germans, and so they created some things in the borders that caused the Germans to have some resentments.
Yeah,
it was Sudetenland, the Sudetenland taking parts out of Poland. Yeah,
Doug, we just have a minute left here. Concluding thoughts on World War I, Minnesota's place in it, and the exhibit that you're putting together.
Well, we're hoping to build a great exhibit. I wish I had four times as much space. World War I has always been a great passion of mine, and we're trying to figure out how to build a trench up there without digging into the floor.
It's a good idea.
But I think we'll make it work, and it's going to cover the whole spectrum, focusing primarily on Minnesota's part. But it'll deal with the early phases before America was involved and how we got involved.
And we'll be able to see this in due course up at Minnesota Military Museum.
Summer of 2016.
Okay, very good. And the Minnesota Historical Society working on one with a broader reach, too, that'll travel, I guess, around the country in a couple of years. Doug, Becky, thank you so much for coming by and enlightening us on a war that many people just don't know much about.
Okay, glad to be here. Thank you so much.
All right. I guess we'll go out with some music, Tom. Is that it, huh?
I think we can make
Let's
that happen.
Let's do that. From World War I, over there, the great George M. Cohan. Song right here. So, folks, thank you very, very much for your company today. Tom and I will return with a lot of music for you this coming Monday, noon, right after the news at noon, playing your requests and dedications. So please do plan on being with us. We love to have your company. We love to have your requests. And have a great weekend and just laugh off the rain. Ha, 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 ha. We'll see you Monday.
Hurry right away, no delays of the day. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to find, to be proud of our boys in line. Over there, send the word over there. That the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drums are coming everywhere. Johnny, show the Hun you're a son of the gun. Hoist the flag and let her fly. Yankee Doodle, do or die. Pack your little kit, show your grit, do your bit. Yankees to the ranks, from the towns and the tanks. Make your mother proud of you, and the old red, white, and blue.